Hello, hello, and welcome back to Arthouse Garage, the snob-free film podcast where we make arthouse, indie, classic, and foreign cinema accessible to the masses. I'm your host, Andrew Swetman, and today we are finishing up our four-episode series on the French New Wave with a special guest, Omaya Jones, and we are looking at the Jacques Demy film, The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. Stick around. Before we get into the show, a quick plug for our Patreon. If you are a fan of Arthouse Garage and want even more, you can sign up now at patreon.com/arthousegarage, and you get ad-free episodes, extended episodes, bonus episodes, and video episodes. All that, plus a discount on merchandise in the Arthouse Garage shop. Go to patreon.com/arthousegarage or find a link in the show notes. And I want to say, this is an episode that will be extended if you have a subscription to the Patreon. Omaya and myself talked quite a while about French movies, but then we got off on a couple of tangents about upcoming movies and representation and all kinds of things. That was really interesting, but it just got really long. So for the hardcore fans, you can go to Patreon and hear the whole thing. But I'm going to cut this down a little bit to be more focused for the main feed. So go to patreon.com/arthousegarage now to sign up and hear the whole thing. Okay, back to the show. Welcome to Arthouse Garage. We've been looking at the French New Wave over the last every other episode for a few weeks here. We started out with the film Vivre Sa Vie, then looked at Jules and Jim, also a bonus episode about the 400 Blows, and then we talked about Agnès Varda with One Sings, the Other Doesn't, and the short film La Jetée by Chris Marker, and today we are wrapping up by talking about Jacques Demy and The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. Our guest for this whole series has been the wonderful Omaya Jones, who's a series regular, podcast regular, and always has a great perspective. Thanks for coming back once again. Omaya, how are you today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to wrap up and anticipate whatever we'll be doing next.
Yeah. I've got a few things in the works. I haven't talked to you about all of that, but yeah, this has been a great series. You know, I feel like it's been a while since we talked because we were doing every other week, but actually I did a 2-week break to do an episode on Memoria, which I was kind of a last minute decision, and then 3,000 Years of Longing. And now we're back. So yeah, I'm really excited to get back into this. This was my first time to watch this film, The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, and definitely have some thoughts. But before we get into all that, really quick, I wanted to plug another thing that Arthouse Garage published recently, and that is I did an interview with a filmmaker named Mark Cousins, who I was really excited to talk to him. He, if you saw that pop up in your podcast feed, but you didn't know who that is, basically, he is a filmmaker and a film critic and a historian. And he, the first thing I ever saw that he made is this long, it's like 15-hour documentary series about the history of film and cinema. It's called The Story of Film and Odyssey. And he's a really interesting guy. He has a very distinctive accent. He's this Irish critic, and he speaks very slowly and intentionally and creates this very kind of moody kind of video essay kind of things with that series. He's done a handful of other things. He did another series called Women Make Film. He's done a film about Orson Welles. Recently, another one about Alfred Hitchcock that's, I think, playing TIFF right now, actually. But I learned that he had an update to his older series, The Story of Film and Odyssey, called The Story of Film, A New Generation. And basically he did two more episodes and he kind of looks at the last 10 years or so and kind of the innovations that have come around in modern times. It's very interesting stuff. And I also had the opportunity to interview him about it. We spoke for about 15 minutes and I was really happy with how it turned out. It was great. Really, really fun to talk with him. So that is in the podcast feed and on YouTube. And I'll link that in the show notes if anyone cares to see it. You're a fan of Mark Cousins. Yes, Omaya?
I did start Women Make Film, but since I first mentioned that I was watching it, I have not gone back to it, not for lack of interest, but just because of life getting in the way. That's the thing that's hard about like these 14-hour series is sometimes you just have to pause it. I did listen to your interview and I thought you asked some really good and insightful questions that I was excited to hear the answers to.
That's great. I feel like I'm getting a little better at interviewing. I enjoy it a lot, but I'm always like nervous when I get into it. I have another cool one coming up in the next episode of the podcast is a filmmaker named Julian Higgins, who directed a film called God's Country. And we did a nice long hour-long talk about his film and some of the things it's based on. So that's fun. That look forward to that for next week. But it was fun, really fun talking with Mark Cousins. It's his series, The Story of Film and Odyssey, was really kind of formative for me. I also took, I don't know, probably a year to watch it just here and there. But I feel like I learned so much about just the history of film and film appreciation from this series. So I highly recommend that. I think it's streaming for free on like Tubi or one of those free weird little streaming services. I rewatched a couple episodes in preparation to talking with him, but yes, check that out. And then the new one is coming out. It's in theaters, limited release now, and it's coming out on VOD in like a week and a half, I think.
So I will probably be waiting. I will probably be waiting for the box set.
Oh yes. Yeah. And there's a Blu-ray box set coming by Christmas with the original series and these new episodes all in one nice Blu-ray package. And the original's never been on Blu-ray before, only DVD. So that's exciting as well. So yes, cool Mark Cousins stuff. And I actually bought the Women Make Film series. I haven't watched that yet either. So, you know, whenever I have 14 hours to spare, I'm sure I'll stretch it out over months.
Well, you know, the thing is, like, I started it and I got like two or three episodes in and I stopped watching that 14-hour series in part to watch like the 6-hour Paul Newman, Joanne Woodward documentary.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So, and then after that, I haven't found the time to get back into it.
Yeah. There's just too much good stuff. And you and I are both pretty busy people. But I did want to ask before we get into Fringe New Wave, if there's anything else you've been watching lately that you wanted to put on our radar.
So I have watched a few things. So I, you know, for National Cinema Day a couple of weeks ago, where every movie was $3. I got to go see Jaws and I realized that even though I had always assumed that I'd seen it, I'm not sure if I'd ever saw it from the very beginning because there were scenes in the beginning that I just didn't recognize. And that was an interesting experience too, just to see it with a crowd of a bunch of people who were different ages and to see that the movie still held up, even though in terms of pacing, it's not anything like a modern film. Like the characters are allowed to develop things, take their time. I was listening to, I think it was something that had to do with like Thor, Love and Thunder. And one of the points they were making was that there are scenes that they shot that were cut in part because like they felt like the audience sort of like got it right. Like we're at this point in blockbuster movie making that there are lots of tropes and things that happen in the course of a story that the audience is just used to so that you can feel like you can skip them. And I appreciated something that allowed for there just to be like a scene where like the three leads are on a boat drinking and nothing is happening in terms of plot, you know? So I appreciated that. After that, we saw 3,000 Years of Longing, which is an interesting film. I'm not sure it's 100% successful. Maybe it's like 80% successful for me. But I appreciated what George Miller was trying to do, I think. And also, it's a film that's sort of about, without trying to spoil it, sort of like the end of things. I likened it to some of my favorite Westerns, that are sort of about this period of time where things are changing. And so like, you think you're watching like a classic Western and all of a sudden there's a car or a reference to an airplane. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, things are about to get different.
Yeah. Interesting.
Well, just, I watched Mysterious Object at Noon.
Which oh yeah. Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. So like the Apichatpong Weerasethakun, film from like 1999, his first feature, I think. And it's like, the format is interesting because it's an experimental film. And what he did was he just went around Thailand and asked different people to sort of tell a story, exquisite corpse style. So when he encountered a new group of people, they would sort of relay what the previous group said or what happened in the story up to that point. And so like, there, everybody sort of is really, it's very collaborative and everybody's sort of participating in that way.
Wow.
And then he shot narrative portions that he inserts along with their stories. And so it's a weird watch, but once you realize what's happening, it's very interesting.
Yeah. I didn't know that was exactly the format. I plan to purchase that, 'cause it's in one of the Martin Scorsese World Cinema Criterion box sets, which I think I have 1 and 3, and that's on number 2. So I just need to complete that. And I think 4 is coming out soon too, which is interesting. But yeah, that I knew that it had something of a strange format, but I did not know that's what it was. Wow. Very excited to watch that. I had just looked into that recently because of all the Weerasethakul love lately and Little Rock and all of that. But I want to say about Jaws, I actually also went to see Jaws on World Cinema Day. Did you see, I think there's like the IMAX option or the 3D option. Which one did you do?
I did the IMAX.
So did I. And I'm wondering if we were in the same theater because we might have been there at the same time. It was like 6:30.
What time did you go?
6:30 or 7:30.
Okay. Like that. I think I got out the showing before that.
Oh, okay.
So I had to like rush home. You were at the Chenal 9?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
We must have been right there. It's interesting that you say that about not having like remembered the beginning scenes, because that's a movie that I think we rented it when I was a kid. Like, I must have been like 10 years old and I probably was bored by it. So I feel like I'd sort of seen it, but not really seen it. And like, I probably was in and out of the room. So that's always a movie that I'm like, yeah, I've kind of seen Jaws, but not really. And so this was like the perfect time to actually sit and watch it with a crowd on the IMAX. Yeah. And I had the same experience. Like, so, people were so engaged. There was one person that was like really afraid and screaming very loud, which was funny. But it was a good time at the movies for sure. And absolutely the masterpiece that I always heard that it was, you know. So that was a good one to finally officially check off.
You got out at 6:30, or you went at 6:30?
I think I went in at 6:30.
Okay, never mind. I asked because I was with someone who was also very vocal.
Okay.
Like he screamed a lot at different parts.
This was a woman who was sitting like right behind me. And like when the submarine, and they find that body in the submarine, or like it's a boat that sunk. Like such a loud scream, it like scared me more because of it. It was like, I wasn't annoyed. I was like, this is fun. Which is actually the other couple things I was going to talk about. One is new movie called Barbarian, which everything I'm seeing on Twitter and everything is like, don't read anything about this. Just go see it, which is true. It's very surprising. So I'll not say anything other than very, very wild ride of a movie and very fun with an audience. So if you're into really kind of messed up horror movies, I have this ritual where if I watch a movie like this, I'll come home and tell my wife the whole plot, like in a lot of detail, because she's not going to watch a movie that's like this. So I've like done that with Hereditary and Midsommar and a couple other things recently, until this was more of a fun, scary movie more than like Hereditary is. So it's a good time, and people are comparing it a little bit to that horror movie from last year that I'm forgetting the name, Malignant, which I think this movie's better than Malignant, but it is similar. Like, it's just like surprising and fun with a crowd, and again had a vocal audience. That was a good time. So recommend Barbarian. It's pretty intense, but yeah, I enjoyed it a lot. And then another, I'm kind of getting into like scary movie season since it's the fall. I watched a movie called We're All Going to the World Fair. Have you seen that?
No, but that I did. I just added that to my HBO Max watch list.
I think it played Sundance or somewhere, and I had been wanting to watch it, and I saw that it hit HBO. I guess I think it had been on VOD for a while, but I really liked it. It's unusual. It's I explained it to someone as sort of like a digital Blair Witch project. Like, it's kind of that some found footage, but it's like we're interacting with our computers and stuff. And it's also related to like the world of like creepypasta kind of online horror things, which is a funny word. If anyone's not familiar, yeah, do you know about creepypastas? I'll explain it for listeners.
I do not.
Okay. So I'm not an expert in this, but if I can explain this, hopefully clearly, there's a type of story called a copy. It's like copy paste, copy pasta. It's sort of like the word became, oh, that's the name of this kind of story. It's like a block of text that you can copy and paste, and the story is shared that way on Reddit and different things online. But then a creepy version of that, a horror version of that, called a creepypasta. So like Slender Man is probably the most prominent creepypasta story. And there's a handful of others where it's just like the medium is important. Like the first one I read that I really liked is called, I'm also thinking, what's the other, hold on. The one that I liked is called, I am a search and rescue officer, or I was a search and rescue officer. And so like the story is, he's telling his experiences of going in deep into the woods to save people in crisis and encountering horrific things there. But like the way it's written is like, it's just as if this guy is just telling his real story on Reddit. And so it's like I didn't at least at first realize this was a constructed thing until you get to a certain point. You're like, oh, this is fictional. This is a narrative, but it's like, it's not clear at first. So that is kind of part of the fun of a creepypasta, I think, is that it's kind of similar to how like the novel Frankenstein or Dracula, they're written like a journal, you know, like when you read it's sort of like gives a feeling of authenticity to it a little bit. It's kind of like an internet version of that, is how I think about it. So anyway, that one. And then there's The Back Rooms. Have you heard of The Back Rooms? It's an interesting YouTube horror thing. That's also from creepypasta lore. And then there's a sci-fi channel show called Channel Zero that I think all the stories from that show are. It's like an anthology horror series. It's supposed to be good. I haven't watched it, but it's an interesting little corner of internet horror stuff. This movie, We're All Going to the World Fair, kind of fits in with that where, I don't want to, there's anything to spoil, but it's just it's very moody. It's got this kind of like grungy shoegaze kind of music, a lot of it. It's this young woman who she's very online, and she does the World's Fair Challenge at the beginning of the movie, which is, it's sort of an occult kind of a ritual kind of thing, but it involves your laptop. And supposedly that when you do that, strange things start happening to you and to your body and different stuff. So that's kind of the setup of it. It's really kind of about internet culture. It's very creepy. And it also, like, something that I really like about it is it like doesn't break the fourth wall like directly. It's not like the characters are talking to you, but it does some things formally that kind of try to break out of your, it'd be great to watch it on a laptop. Actually, I think that would make sense. But for instance, at one point she's watching some weird internet videos on a projector screen that's onto a sheet in a wall. And it's like strobing in the screen, and like it's causing the whole room around her to strobe, like the walls are lighting up, and the camera zooms in to where like the screen is your screen, and now my walls are also strobing in my house. So it kind of sucks you in that way. So it does some really creative formal things. A lot of it's like really grainy video footage. I read an interview with the filmmaker about how they wanted to incorporate all kinds of, you know, digital things. Anyway, this is kind of going long about this movie, but I really did enjoy it. And now everyone knows about creepypasta culture on the internet. Yeah. but yes, highly recommend if you're into that sort of thing. It's quite an experience, and it's kind of kind of exhausting maybe, but I really liked it.
Do you ever do that that 30 or whatever people do in October where they try to watch like a scary movie every night?
I haven't done that. I've thought about it. I wish I could just watch, you know, three movies in a week, you know. It's kind of like, I feel like I don't have quite enough time in my life to do that. Maybe one day I'll have enough margin for that, but not this year, certainly. But that would be cool. But yeah, I do tend to watch more scary stuff around this time of year just to get in the spirit of Halloween. Well, we can wrap up that kind of long segment of what we've been watching and talk about today's subject, which is the French New Wave and the Umbrellas of Cherbourg. So, yeah, we've talked about what is the French New Wave, and then we talked about the Left Bank and who that is and kind of what's different about that group of filmmakers. Jacques Demy fits into that category, correct? The Left Bank?
Yeah, sure. We can talk about that.
Yeah. So maybe yes with an asterisk. And he also was married to Agnès Varda, who we talked about last time. So very connected. And this is a movie that I, you know, again, another one that's been on my list forever that I'm finally glad to have watched. And I really liked it a lot. But we'll get into that. So I guess tell us about Jacques Demy and what's his kind of place in the French New Wave?
Yeah, so Jacques Demy, obviously, was a French director. He was married to Agnès Varda. I guess that they met at a short film festival and then married a few years after that. And they were together from that point until he died in 1990. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I think is sort of interesting is that when he died, they announced that he died of cancer. But then Agnès Varda revealed, I think it was in The Beaches of Agnes, that he actually died of HIV AIDS and that he was gay.
That's very surprising. I didn't know that.
And so when they got together, she already had her daughter, who's also in the film as the daughter at the, at the inn in the car. But, they did have a son together as well. And, you know, he served in the military. He got out early for like some sort of medical leave. And I think, you know, he was like a lot of the Left Bank directors. He had more varied interests. So he, in addition to cinema, he was into writing and jazz and different things. And so that was sort of where he came from. That was his perspective.
Yeah. The jazz definitely comes in this film a lot. And I, so it's interesting. I knew that this was a musical, but I did not know it was basically an opera. Like there's no spoken dialogue in the whole movie. It's just kind of all singing. I'm getting ahead of myself, but that's interesting too, because so I knew that they had the two kids. And so I think it's Rosalie Demy Varda or Varda Demy, who's also in One Sings, the Other Doesn't. And she's not in a lot of movies. I didn't plan that, but we picked her two movies that she's in. And she, this is cool, she liked my Instagram post. She's still living and active on Instagram. And I just tagged, I think I tagged One Sings, the Other Doesn't. And she liked it. I was like, oh my gosh, it's Rosalie Varda. I watched an interesting thing about the restoration of this film that she speaks in, and so does their son. So that's an interesting kind of bringing that all together. So what is his reputation like as far as a filmmaker? Like, does he have stylistic things that are different, or does he have a reputation that's different than other French directors at the time?
Yeah, I would say one of the things that stands out is I think Umbrellas of Cherbourg, and then after that, maybe The Young Girls of Roquefort are his most well-known films. And I think that they're his most technically accomplished. And it's interesting because when we first started talking about the French New Wave and we were talking about Truffaut and what he was talking about in terms of quality cinema, like Demy very much like oscillates back and forth between these two artistic styles. So like his first couple of films visually fit more firmly in what you would think of as like a French New Wave aesthetic, black and white. They're very almost casual, I think is the term that they use to describe it. Naturalistic, very little lighting, artificial lighting. But with Umbrellas, you can clearly see that there's money. And it has this very sort of like classical stylistic aesthetic to it. Mm-hmm. So like there's lots of colors and sets. It's a very planned film. And I think he was trying to channel and sort of reimagine like a Hollywood musical style of storytelling, which is why it has that unique form. But I think, so there's a point in the making of where there are several people who sort of answer this question about whether or not he fits in the new wave. And so like they have like audio of him saying, you know, I started out along with the new wave because I was the same age as a number of colleagues and journalists. Francois Giron labeled us the new wave, and it was a label applied to that year's vintage, says to me, which is, I think, is sort of interesting. It's sort of like his relationship with the label. And then Varda says new wave was a very vague term that put enormously different people in the same basket. Zoc's films are a million miles from Godard. However much we like him, or Romare or Chabrol, they're very different. Renee Marker, herself, Jacques, they're all different, and they're all called new wave. It's the 60s. Let's go. It's sort of like her sort of poo-pooing the idea. But then Legrand, who is the composer for Umbrellas and Cherbourg, says that he was sort of talking about how, like, yes, it's different from those other films, but just like in a family, some children in the family are quiet and others are exuberant. Kids come in all shapes and sizes, and Jacques was the quiet child. And so he's saying, like, yes, it's different aesthetically and stylistically from other new wave films, but it's still sort of it's in the same spirit or a similar spirit.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It does. I mean, it immediately felt pretty different than the other three films that we've watched, just because it's a musical for one thing. But yeah, just the energy to it is different. It does feel a bit more like, I don't know, a classical Hollywood film that I'm used to. Yeah, it definitely stood out. It's probably my favorite of the four that we watched, actually, too. But I really liked everything that we've done in the series. But I really, really like this a lot.
Yeah, I think one way that it is like a lot of the other films that we watch, or at least the Truffaut films or the Varda films, is that it is more autobiographical. Vaguely, you know, like he grew up around a gas station. I think his father worked at a gas station, and sort of like that feeds into it. So he's pulling elements from his life and putting it into the film. And I think one of the things about that quality cinema that they were critiqued is that a lot of those were literary adaptations, or, you know, like they were big and expensive pictures. And so I think in terms of the content, this does fit more firmly in terms of what I think what the new wave was doing. And so then you get into this, you can have a discussion about sort of like content versus form, I guess, you know, in terms of like, what are you really talking about when you're trying to categorize things?
Yeah, it does. I think the way the story goes did remind me of like one sings the other doesn't, for instance, with kind of it's sort of a love triangle, but we ended up with sort of an unusual dynamic and family situation. So yeah, it feels like a marriage, you're right, between sort of more classical Hollywood filmmaking and kind of the French new wave stuff that we've been getting. It definitely feels like it fits in the new wave stuff that we've watched, but it is it feels different, as I was saying. But yeah, well, let's talk about the film. So how many times have you seen this film?
This is the second time for me.
Okay.
The first time I saw it was specifically because it was referenced as an influence for La La Land. So I'd say, I'll watch it after that.
I thought about La La Land as I was watching this, and I also thought La La Land could never. Like, this is so good. Yeah, I don't want to hate on La La Land. I like La La Land. But this movie is so good. What I knew about this going in is like, it's a musical. It's very colorful. I think that's really about all I knew. And that it has Catherine Deneuve as the lead, and this was kind of a breakout. But my goodness, I was so the colors were more exuberant than I could have imagined, and yet it doesn't feel like, one thing that I read about Jacques Demy is that for a while he kind of had a reputation, maybe among more like American critics, I'm not sure, I read this the essay on Criterion's website, that he had a reputation as being a bit, I don't know, less serious or more like his films are curiosities. They're not as you know, as hard hitting as like the films of Truffaut or of Godard, and that kind of feeling has maybe dissipated over the years. But because it is, you know, it's a, at least on the surface, it seems like, oh, it's a sweet musical love story, but it's actually got way more dramatic teeth than that. And it's mm-hmm. also just the colorful style of it in particular. I don't know, describing it to someone might make it sound like, I don't know, like bubblegum, kind of like so over the top kind of, I'm just thinking about like, I'm trying to think of a comparison, but just something that's so colorful and like Sugar Rush visually kind of a movie, but it's more, mm-hmm. it's not that. At least I didn't have that experience. Like it's very bright and like eye catching, but there are a handful of scenes actually that don't have the bright colors as much. And we can talk about those, but it, I don't know, it felt like it worked and it was heightened, but it still felt like it was grounded in reality, maybe because of the how dramatic the plot is. But anyway, yeah. What do you think about the style of this?
So Demy describes himself not as an intellectual, but as a humanist or an emotionalist. And mm-hmm. so like, he's really trying to find those broader emotions. And so where like Godard maybe becomes like, you know, he gets to the point where he's sort of making these video essays. Demy is sort of like sentimental and he's working class, blue collar type of background. Mm-hmm. And one of the things Varda said about him was just that he was never explicitly political. He was never an activist. When she would have these big feminist gatherings at their home, he might get annoyed just because, you mm-hmm. know, there'd be like 40 women in the house and he, yeah. you know, had to sort of navigate around that. But mm-hmm. he was liberal. He was a leftist. But you know, he was more like I don't know. I kind of like him to like a Joe Biden versus, I don't know, someone else. Cause like he's like pro union, right? Pro worker. Mm-hmm. Sort of like that's where he comes from in his politics, but his films mm-hmm. are never explicitly political. But yeah. of course, we're going to talk about when we get to the plot of this film, there is sort of like maybe a critique of like France foreign policy and the war mm-hmm. and sort of like what that does to people. One of the things that I was looking for in terms of like the style of the film and the color is at some point I was trying to figure out, is it just me imposing my vision on the film, or are the colors less vibrant as it goes along? And I think it's mostly just me thinking about that. Of course, there are scenes that are shot like at the train station where they're yeah. not as vibrant, mm-hmm. but I think I want it thematically for the colors to pop less as the film got more melancholy.
Yeah. I think that I noticed it just in a few moments, like you're saying, like the train scene. Mm-hmm. There's a scene in a church near the end. I'm trying to remember the exact context, but it's suddenly the colors are very drab. It's a funeral scene. That's what. Mm-hmm. So that kind of makes sense that it's not as vibrant. But then I think the final, like the finale section, it's so that I like that you brought up the gas station stuff. That's such an interesting thing. Like he has sort of this romantic vision of the gas station too, like he talks about it as his perfume and they kind of joke about that, but then he has this model like of this fancy Esso gas station, which I guess in our terms it's more like a garage, like you go and get your car fixed there too. It's not just like a, you know, a Shell station, you know, that we have here, but it's like your car goes there, and he has this model in his room and he dreams about building one. And this is not really a spoiler film. We're going to go ahead and talk about the whole movie, but at the end he has this nice garage, but it's all white. And like, so we've had the vibrant umbrella shop, and at the end we have this like kind of more modern looking white building, and it's snowing outside. So it's like sapped of the color mostly. Like there's a Christmas tree and stuff. So it's not that it's just black and white or anything, but there's a lot more just kind of like white tones in that final scene. So I think maybe it sort of does that, what you're saying, but maybe I would have to look back and see. But I guess like in the umbrella shop, it stays the same kind of vibrancy the whole time.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Apparently Varda said that, this is on the subject of the gasoline or the perfume, that, she wouldn't have believed it if she hadn't heard Jacques say something to the equivalent of, I think the exact quote is, "One thing in the film struck me, I wouldn't have believed it if I hadn't heard Jacques say it. There's nothing better in the morning than a croissant and the smell of gasoline. And because he had these fond memories of his mother, who apparently would like make him croissants for breakfast, and then also like be working in the gas station or just being around it.
That's funny. Yeah, that's such an it's like such a smell that, you know, it you know it when they talk about it. So you can almost, it's like a nice sensory touch, I think, to bring in the smelling of that. Yeah, I really like that. The music obviously is so great. Like I also didn't really know it was going to be like basically jazz. Like it opens with that. There's opening credits, but then it gets into the garage and he's, it's just so vibrant. And the essay that I read on Criterion talked about like the stream of consciousness, almost feeling where they're just all flowing together kind of thing. But yeah, the I think my favorite moment in the whole film, like it involves the themes, which we get like in the opening credits. There's sort of a theme that comes back again, a musical theme, like a little musical motif. But there's a few times when it kind of suddenly comes into the middle of another song, and it kind of gets more dramatic and heavy as it goes along too. Like the finale it's that, and it gets more like bigger and grander as it goes on. But it's in the middle of the movie where, so if you haven't seen it, the story is she's very much in love with this guy named Guy. Her name is Genevieve, and her mother owns an umbrella shop, the Umbrellas of Cherbourg. And she spends a lot of time there. She's so in love. Her mother's against it because they're too young. He has to go off and do military service, find out that she's pregnant, and her mother's trying to set her up with another guy. So there's like a love triangle kind of thing going on. And I like the progression of how that goes, because it's so gradual that she sort of lets go of her first love in a way, like gradually over the film, even though she's pregnant with this child, which is really interesting kind of situation. But the song that I really love, I think it's the first time we hear her even entertain the idea that maybe she won't end up with him. And it's, she and her mother are kind of arguing. Her mother's like, you're too young for him. Like, we have this guy here who's very capable of taking care of you. And I think at this point he's already found out that she's pregnant. He still, you know, he wants to raise the child and like that be their family. But it's there. So they're kind of having this argument. And then she kind of turns and looks out the window. And then it's the second section of the film is called The Absence. So there's I can't remember what the beginning is. There's like 3 seconds of the film, but it's his absence as he's gone in the war. She turns out the window and sings this line. I'll read it exactly because I wrote it down. I don't want to mess it up. It's a really simple line, but this is, why is absence so heavy to bear? And it, as she sings that, that theme comes back. So that we haven't heard it in a while. And so she sings that kind of very heavy line, suddenly very, very full of emotion and like on the verge of tears seeming. And she sings, why is absence so hard to bear? And it's in that series of notes. And it just really hit me. And I really love that moment. If you want to find it on the soundtrack on streaming, I found it earlier. The track is called The Carnival, La Carnival. But yeah, it's a conversation between her and her mother. Do you have any favorite moments from the film?
Trying to think if I should go ahead and confess this now or not. Okay. I don't like this movie.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. It's like the thing. It. So here's what I would say. If I could just watch it silent with the musical score, I think it would work a lot better for me. But the actual singing it just kind of annoys me because they're not real songs. I kind of like, and visually I love watching it. I love the colors. I love the set design. I love everything about it, except for the fact that regular dialogue is sung throughout the film.
Interesting.
Cause it just sounds kind of weird to me.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah. I was going to ask, do you generally like musicals? But I was trying to think of something else that's like basically an opera like this. And the only thing I can think of is Hamilton, but that's like rapping. So it's different anyway. But I'm trying to think if there's any other like film opera.
Well, also like, you know, those are like real songs too, right? Yeah. Like you can, like you can put on Hamilton and listen to, I think the closest thing would be Annette.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. Very much so. Yeah.
And like, even those songs are very hit and miss to me.
Yeah, that's true.
Like the first song is like the only like really real song. But then like when he's like singing his stand up, when Adam Driver's character is singing his stand up, is like, this doesn't always really work for me.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely like, just like people who like struggle with musicals at all, like the idea that someone's going to burst into song throws them off. Like if this, that's that times a million. Right. So it's, yeah, I can see how it wouldn't work. But
yeah,
it's interesting.
But see, I like musicals. That doesn't. I can dig a musical. Although, like one of the things Jock to me talked about is, you know, there are musicals where it seems like whenever there's a song, the plot just grinds to a halt, or there's a 3-minute song about how the character is feeling, and I think there's a way to integrate the songs into the plot and the story where it's not so halting and not so distracting. And so,
yeah,
you know, Hamilton is an example where the whole thing, the singing throughout, and it's all plot and all emotion, all driving the story forward. Disney, I think, generally does, like in their heyday, I think they did a pretty good job, right? Like when you think of like those 90s classics, like The Lion King, or Aladdin or The Little Mermaid, like those, their songs are well integrated into those films.
Yeah.
I think also I have a general rule of thumb that if there's a musical number, it's a musical regardless of how many musical numbers there are. So like to me, something like All That Jazz is clearly a musical, even though there's lots of spoken dialogue. But it, I love that movie, you know?
Yeah. So this was your second time to watch it. So you, you knew when I selected this film for the podcast that you weren't a fan of it. Did you enjoy it any more the second time or any less? Or the same?
No, I think. So the two things that really bother me is one, I just don't think the songs are that well integrated, or I don't think the singing is that well integrated into the film. And the other thing is like, I think that renders it kind of shallow. So like it's very like broad, like this painted, the emotions are very broad stroke. And and I feel like I, as a viewer, am doing a lot of work to sort of like fill in the gaps of who these characters are. And I think that he wanted a kind of universality. He said that he was trying to make something that would make someone, that something that would feel tender and make you think about your first love. And he thinks he succeeded, right? Like he wanted to make people cry. But I, when I watch a film, I'm not projecting myself onto characters. That's just like not the way that I watch a lot of film. I don't really get emotionally connected with most things, even if I really like them. And so like, I want you to tell me more about who these characters are. I'm often looking for people that aren't like me. So I need, I want more specifics.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And I think that's of course, totally valid reaction to it. I did feel like what he's saying a little bit, like, they're not, there's not a ton of depth to the characters, but they are, they're almost archetypes in a way of like, young love, first love, Romeo and Juliet kind of connection that isn't always necessarily the most reasonable or smartest choice in the long term. Right. And in this situation, it's just circumstances pulled them apart. And yeah, I definitely, it did make me think about like situations in your own life where, you know, like what could have been, kind of, you know, wonder that about, you know, people in your past and that sort of thing. So yeah, it worked on that level for me that I guess he was going for. But yeah, and I think I'm thinking about the Annette connection too. That movie is such, and that movie too is different because people just repeat the same thing over and over in their song, and it kind of hammers down these plot points or emotional beats, which this didn't do that quite as much, but it is just kind of carrying along. I think once I got into the vibe of this after like 2 or 3 minutes, I was pretty much into it. So yeah, that's, yeah, interesting. I, you know, different strokes, I guess, but it's funny. I just said this is my favorite thing that we've watched. Like, I don't like it. Oh no. But yeah, it's interesting. Cause like I kind of knew about this movie. I know that his next one, this is the only thing I've seen of his. But there's like a box set that Criterion has. And I've always like, maybe one day I'll kind of want that. But now I'm like, oh yeah, that's like priority. Like I really want to get that over.
Well, I definitely want to. I want to watch more
things. Yeah, I'm curious to see a non-musical by him for sure too.
did you realize that all of the actors singing was dubbed?
Yes.
By other actors.
Oh, by other singers. No, I didn't. I did not realize that.
They're not their voice. Yeah.
I was sure that it wasn't live. There's like at a certain point, I was like, okay, yeah, this is like ADR or whatever. But no, I didn't realize it's a different voices. In fact, that is.
Yeah. Surprising. So what they did was like, once he had the script, he worked with Michel Legrand, the composer. Mm-hmm. And at first they had to like crack the code of how they were going to make it work. Mm-hmm. And then they cast it, and then they cast it with actors who couldn't necessarily sing. Mm-hmm. And so they decided to get singers to dub over them. And so it's kind of interesting because like those singers would rehearse with the actors, mm-hmm. and they would sort of collaborate on sort of like how they would deliver those lines. So there's an example that Catherine Deneuve gives where, or someone gave this example, like she was working with her singer and she was like, I wouldn't say that way. And so like they sort of worked on the performance together. And so then they recorded essentially like a cast album, and they would lip sync to that on set. So they rehearsed to that. And so everything was sort of pre-recorded. So it's not like you're rehearsing and then you get to improv on set because you're doing it to this pre-recorded album. So everything had to be planned out to the second.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Because when you first said that, I was like, oh, they must have just recorded it. And then the actors essentially lip synced it, which is what they did. But the fact that they... Mm-hmm. work together, because then if you just show up and lip sync, then you're just a puppet and you're not really even acting, except I guess physicality of it. But yeah, that is such a fascinating way to do it. But it makes sense that way it's still your performance in a sense, even though it's not your voice. I should have realized that because I listened to the cast album and I was like, it doesn't say Catherine Deneuve anywhere on the track list. So I should have made that connection. But yeah, wow, that's fascinating. So, and a couple of the things on the Varda Criterion box set are like one of the discs I think is all about Jacques Demy. And so I'm trying to remember what's on there, but it's like, it's a documentary about him that she made, correct?
Yes. Which I wanted to watch, but did not get to. But that's fine. Cause I still have like 4 pages of notes. So,
well, what else do you have to say?
She made a narrative film about his childhood and a documentary after that. So she made at least two films about Demy. She really loved him, you know, and I don't know what their personal life was like. I think she was very guarded about that. I mean, again, like he died in 1990 and it was like 18 or 19 years later before she revealed how he actually died. But yeah, you know, like, you know, it's not, I did write down as it started, like I had to pause the film just to write down. It's like, I really love the color. And I was thinking like a lot of superhero films could take lessons from this. Mm-hmm. And one of the special features that are on the channel, they pointed out how at this point in time, you know, this was the heyday of pop art. So like Lichtenstein was painting, everything was bright and colorful. And this film sort of channels that spirit. And of course, like, you know, Lichtenstein, love him, hate him, I'm not a big fan, but, you know, what he would do in his art was like copy panels from comic books. And so it's like, this thing is like, he's not afraid of color. Demy's not afraid of the color. And I wish I like a lot of films today, like these big blockbusters would sort of like use some of this, like you don't have to desaturate your palette so much, like let the colors be.
Yeah, it's very saturated for sure. That's something that kind of jumps out at you. And so, well, yeah, one of the things that I was able to research a little bit, there's a video, I think it's probably on the disc or on the channel, but it's also on YouTube, and Criterion has it just as a blog post, but it's about the restoration. It's like a short little documentary. And it reminds me of like the Technicolor process where you have, you know, three film strips of the different kind of primary colors that come together. But yet it's got Agnes Varda talking about that, and it's got Rosalie Varda Demy, and then their son whose name is Matthew something, I think, all kind of talking about that. And then there's a couple, you know, just, I always love seeing those like before and after restoration kind of things. So that's a really fascinating little video that I'll put together. But apparently, and something else I read too, is that like, this film did decently well, like was pretty popular in the theater, but then the home video transfers were never capturing the color as well. And so it kind of wasn't as popular for years because of that. But I think in like 1993, it was restored, or maybe 2003, one of those two, I can't remember. But since then, it's kind of had a second life of getting the color right and having a better viewing experience.
Yeah, I think they call it like the Eastman process. Yeah, that's right. Which I wonder, I'm sure it's related to like the George Eastman Museum, and which is, I think, like around Buffalo, New York, where they have the Nitrate Film Festival. Are you familiar with this?
I think you like mentioned it films. Before.
Yeah. But correct me if I'm wrong. Do you know, like, the Technicolor process works where they're on, like, on set, I think you have a camera that would shoot multiple, right?
Yeah, in the different colors, got, like, right? Three lenses kind of pointing in one spot.
Right. Yeah. But then the way they describe this process was like, well, you take that camera negative and then you print after the fact the different primary colors is what it sounded like.
And then you lay those over each other.
Right. And so, and I think that's why they're more vibrant than a lot of, like, Technicolor, I guess it depends on like also what era of Technicolor you're looking at. And also supposedly like, those films that were shot on nitrate film were very, very vibrant. And I guess like I've never seen a nitrate projected film. And I would like, you know, that's one of the reasons I'd like to go to like the Nitrate Film Festival is just to, like to see like, even if it's just like the trailer for The Wizard of Oz, how it would have looked.
Something. Yeah.
Potentially like,
Yeah. That's fascinating. Wow. Well, I really like this a lot. I had a couple other like moments to bring up that I really liked. One is where she's about to get married. So as the story progresses, she kind of acquiesces to this other guy, and whose name is escaping me, but it is Roland. She agrees to get married to him, and that's kind of the second section of the film ends. But there's this interesting shot where it cuts to, she's like in a bridal shop. And again, it's all white at this point. There's no vibrant colors. And she's like putting on a veil. And then she looks like basically right into the camera. And there's this really, maybe a more direct close up than we've gotten in the whole movie, where she's, you know, obviously she's feeling very conflicted about the marriage. And then it cuts to the wedding scene. And the music is, it feels off a piece with the rest of it, but it sounds like the music you might hear at a wedding. It's kind of an organ piece, but it also sounds kind of like a dirge. Like it sounds like a funeral song. Mm-hmm. And I think it's kind of capturing like such a mixed feeling that she has, like in a way, this is the death of her dream that she initially wanted. And it's like every relationship is the death of all other possible relationships. Right. So I think that's a really cool way to capture that musically, right there in that moment. And then that fades to black at the end of the second section of the film. I really like that a lot.
Yeah. Actually, I love that sequence. Like, see, again, the film overall doesn't work for me, but like that sequence, I really like that. I like the way it was handled because it's one of the few, if not only, montages in the film. And like one of the things that I like, this is what I really love about like Michael Mann, which is just that the way his films work. Like, have you seen Last of the Mohicans?
I've not.
Or even like Heat, like just like the way it works is like, it's just all talking for like an hour and a half. But like all of that talking allows for a climax that's maybe like 20 minutes of essentially just like of like a music video of like montage. It's like character. It's just like action over music. And so it's like the payoff is like, okay, yes, I made you sit through an hour and a half of this dense thing about like colonial era pacts between like Native Americans and colonialists and the English. But now I'm going to give you like 20 to 30 straight minutes of just like people acting and sort of like all of this energy that's been repressed just bursting out. So they're like this build up and release. There's another one. Oh yeah. Like his, like the Miami Vice movie is like kind of works the same way. I love that. I love just like the way it's like all of this dense packing in of information that just gives way to this release. And so I kind of wish like this had been more like that. I wish it had been denser up front so that then at the end it was like nothing but sequences like that wedding sequence. Cause I really like that. And there are also like other times when he comes over for dinner, there's a shot where They sort of take turns with just close-ups of almost looking into the camera straight on. Mm-hmm. And I like, yeah. I love those stylistic flourishes. Like that stuff really works for me.
Yeah. Yeah. The structure of this film is more like it's kind of light and airy and then gradually mm-hmm. gets heavier and heavier and heavier, which I think is also, you know, it's like loss of innocence that kind of reflects real life in a way kind of thing. But yeah, that's going to be, yeah, I really like yeah, the wedding sequence, the dinner table sequence that you're talking about. Yeah, and then I really like the final sequence too. I think it works. And actually what I love about the ending is, so yeah, they're in the snow. They've left town. She and her mother have left town, but now he has opened a garage there and she just shows up. And it's not clear if she like knew that's where he would be or not, if they mm-hmm. just happened to be meeting. And she has their child, but of course it's, she's being raised by, you know, her husband. And they have an interaction and then she leaves and it's like, obviously that's such a bittersweet moment. But then as the camera pulls back at the end, his wife and child come home and like, he's playing with his child. And like, I love that. That's the final thing we see is him playing with his son. And it gives such an interesting emotional dimension to that scene, which does, it is that can see like stylistically where La La Land took things from the colors and everything, but also like the way that story ends is kind of emotionally similar to this, I think. So yeah, that's interesting. But yeah, I really liked the way this ended for sure.
Yeah. La La Land also stole, well, not stole. It's basically a remake of New York, New York.
Oh, I've never seen that.
So like in the past, like 5 years or two Academy Award recognized films, one actually, no. I don't know if Joker won anything, but like King of New York and New York, New York or Joker and the King of Comedy.
King of Comedy, yeah.
Yeah, you're right. And then La La Land and New York, New York are like, you know, Scorsese is just on everybody's mind.
Yeah, wow. Wow. Well, what else did you have to say about this film before we kind of wrap up our series on French New Wave?
One thing that was way over my head until I was watching some of the supplements was so going back to the idea of Demi as not being explicitly political, but I guess sort of the dynamic at the time was someone pointed out that there's a difference of social classes that are portrayed in the film. So like the idea is that like being a shopkeeper's daughter in those days is sort of like a springboard to the middle class. Whereas being an auto mechanic is not necessarily. And the idea is that this match was never meant to be just because of, you know, disparity and sort of like stations in life.
Wow. Which is interesting too. It kind of connects back to Romeo and Juliet that I mentioned, but also then Roland, the man that her mother wants her to end up with, is like this jewelry salesman and he like travels the world and he's clearly well off and more than they are. So yeah, that does add another dimension to it. Like I thought a little bit about like, oh, she wants him to be with this rich guy, but I didn't think so much about the class difference between even where she's at and where he is, where guy is.
Yeah. And yeah, it makes some sense, right? Because, the other thing is like, cause the whole, for the first portion of the film is like in like chunks of like 1 or 2 months, but really it's like the same night, or like within like a day of her saying, you shouldn't go out with this other guy.
Yeah.
She's like, you should marry this guy. She's like trying to set it up. So I was like, okay, it's not just her age. That's not her only motivation. There's something else going on here why she doesn't want her. Yeah. The other thing that I would point out is just that as Guy as a character, you know, when the film starts out, he's like constantly moving and full of energy. Mm-hmm. And he says like he does what he wants or he lives, he's like something to that effect. But then like when he comes back from the war and he's been injured and that, like his whole perception has changed. He's depressed. He's withdrawn. Sort of melancholy. He goes to a brothel and then he goes like to a cafe or a bar and then to a brothel. And then, you know, it's like this whole thing. Yeah. I'm just trying to like hide his pain, of course, which includes the fact that the person who was supposed to be waiting for him is no longer waiting for him, right? Like yeah. he's lost her.
And his child. To accept that. Yeah. Yeah.
No.
Yeah. That's where like the idea that this is just some like pop song of a movie doesn't add up, because it gets really heavy in that sequence. Yeah. And like, I was like, wow, this like really is going deeper than you might expect it to after the way it opens. But yeah, that especially that sequence where he's so distraught and then goes to the brothel and everything. I'll say that I thought as soon as we saw the I guess the keeper, that Madeline, who takes care of his aunt, I was like, she's going to be important. Like she has star entrance or something. Like you can tell that she's going to be significant. But yeah, I thought that was a good sequence as well. But yeah, the physicality part that you're bringing up is, yeah, I think important too. Because yeah, at the beginning he's so full of energy, and that's drained out over the film too. And then that final sequence, he's like very kind of stoic as he talks to her and not like moving at all. But then his child comes home and he loosens up. So that kind of gives a little bit of it a contrast to that. But yeah, interesting. Well. Should we wrap up our Cherbourg talk and move into kind of a looking back at the series so far? Yeah, I don't have anything specific to bring up with this, but I'm just curious, you know, looking back at the four that we've done, is there anything new that you feel like you learned about all of this stuff, or do you have a favorite film or favorite moment from a film, or kind of any looking back kind of thoughts?
Yeah, I think like the one thing that ties all of these together is just an exploration of creativity, mm-hmm. you know, and just like trying to find new ways to express yourself artistically. And I think like you cannot overstate the impact that they've had on cinema as a group and individually.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. The creativity thing you're saying, I'm thinking about like La Jetée and what a creatively rich film that is, and how... Yeah, like it doesn't follow the rules of what you would expect. And like all of these, like I think that's one of the first things I heard about French New Wave. It was like they kind of broke the rules and changed the way we think about movies. And yeah, I think that's really on display in La Jetée and an Umbrella of Cherbourg, I think. But then I know like Godard's style. It's funny because I think I said this when we talked about Godard, but like so much of what they did that was revolutionary is now like not so uncommon in film. And so like when I see it from 2022, I don't recognize how revolutionary it is just because I was living at the time. So it's the things that I can recognize more easily, I guess, is like the more extreme things like La Jetée. But yeah, I know like the documentary style of filmmaking that we saw on display in Jules and Jim and Vivre Sa Vie was really revolutionary for the time. And yeah. And I think my biggest takeaway probably from the whole thing is that I think Varda is just incredible, and everything I've seen of hers is so good. And like, I'm kind of determined to dig into more of her things. And also now Jacques Demy, I'm really excited to finally have seen one of his films and hopefully one of many, but.
I was going to say, yeah, I think like I'm pretty sure Umbrellas is the only Demy film that I've seen, even including Shores. But I think Varda is just head and shoulders above the rest of the filmmakers for me. Mm-hmm. Because, again, so going back to like sort of what me saying like what I like about films or things or films about people that aren't like me. And like she really imbued her films with her essence and her being. Mm-hmm. And they're sort of like, you know, they're about these causes of the day. They're still relevant politically in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And I love that.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's so interesting that like she is, you know, not a household name in the way that even like someone like Godard, I feel like people probably know his name more than they know the name Varda. But she has such an enormous body of work, and yeah, I think a new appreciation of her has probably been one of my takeaways as well from this series. I, you know, going into this, just wanted to like learn more about this. That's kind of why I select the series that I do. And I definitely feel like I've learned so much and really kind of, there was always like, oh, the French New Wave was a big deal. And I kind of understood why, but I was like, I need to dive into this and watch some things and talk through it with somebody. And so thank you, Amaya, for being that person and for bringing so much, so much kind of knowledge to the podcast with that. Do you have, of the films we've watched, is there a favorite or is there like, I think I can go through each film and think about like a moment that I, that sticks in my brain from each one or something. Do you have a favorite film or favorite moment or anything?
Yeah. You know, I think going into this, my favorite would have been Jules and Jim. Hmm. And it still might be, you know, that there's just something about that I love. Also, La Jete holds up really well. But I was really surprised by like one sings, the other doesn't. And I was glad to see that because I, you know, I hadn't, that was one that I hadn't caught up with. Especially, yeah, you know, actually, I guess I'm a sucker for letter writing in films too. Like the whole back and forth scene was like the way it used narration. I really love that. I really like dug into that.
Yeah, that is a really great setup. All of these films, I think, have an interesting structure. And that's like, because even like Umbrellas that we just watched, it has the kind of chapters in a way or the big section. It's almost like the thirds of the movie, almost like the acts of the movie. But then, yeah, like Viva Savi had the chapter markers. And then I guess Jules and Jim was maybe a little more straightforward, but it had the big break in the middle where it's like, you know, years later after the war. But yeah, the One Sings the Other Does, and has such an inventive format with that stuff. That really works well. Yeah, I think if I had to say a favorite, I think I'd have to say Umbrellas of Cherbourg, but One Sings the Other Doesn't, I think, is right behind it for me because of that, because the music in that film I really like as well. And yeah, just how relevant that film feels still. And yeah, all the things you said about how humanistic she is as a director.
This is the only one that had sort of like an upbeat bit ending.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's very true. Yeah. I'm so glad we watched The 400 Blows as well. That's another one that I had always meant to catch up with. And yeah, I think that, yeah, there's like moments from each film. So like The 400 Blows, I think about the ending. And I also think about the sequence in like the tilt-a-whirl thing or whatever at the park. Such a cool sequence. With Jules and Jim, I keep thinking about them running across the bridge and how fun that sequence is. With One Sings the Other Doesn't, it's that song that I talked about when we talked about that, when she's riding with on the boat on the ferry with all the other quote knocked up ladies, and that's how she puts it in the song. And it's all these women who come for their reproductive rights in this other country in Amsterdam, and that's such a haunting and kind of quirky moment in that film. But then Umbrellas of Cherbourg, I just think about the colors, but it's that moment I talked about, I think, in the middle of the movie where the music comes in and she has that kind of wistful moment. But yes, all good films. I'm really glad that I've watched all of these. Yeah. So thank you so much for going on this cinematic journey with me, Amaya. I appreciate it.
Literally anytime.
Thanks as always. And we'll have you back soon.
All right. Thank you.
Huge thanks to Amaya. This has been such a great series. I hope you agree. And I just feel so much more knowledgeable now than I did at the beginning of the series. Coming up on the show on the next episode, talking about a new film called God's Country that is coming out in limited release. So check your local listings. I believe it is going to play, if you are an Arkansas listener, I think it is going to play in Central Arkansas. I will double check that and tweet it out. But very exciting because my guest on the show is the film's director. His name is Julian Higgins. This is a film I was really impressed with. I saw it at the Bentonville Film Festival, met him there. We talked, connected, and I said, I'd love to have you on the show. It's a movie that just is rich and has a lot to talk about. And it's an adaptation of a short story that I was able to check out at my local library. The short story is called Winter Light by a writer named James Lee Burke. If you want to check it out yourself, and the film is called God's Country, starring Tandy Wei Newton. She is a college professor who lives in a beautiful house in the mountains of Montana and begins to be tormented by some hunters who want to use her land to hunt, and she denies them access to that, and things kind of escalate from there. But it's really, really well done. Very tense film. A lot of interesting, just very timely sort of political things going on within it. Really, really well written. So check out the film. The podcast is coming next week. And that will do it for this episode of Art House Garage. Thank you so much for listening. We've got a few years worth of episodes now. You can hear all of them in your podcast app of choice. Our theme music is by composer Paul Hunefeld. Learn more at appallingproductions.com. And if you want to support Art House Garage, become a patron over at patreon.com/arthousegarage, or there's a link in the show notes. You can also buy an Art House Garage t-shirt at arthousegarage.com/shop. If you want to support us without spending any money, leave a rating or review in your podcast app, and that really helps out the show. Stay in the loop about Art House Garage and the films we're covering by subscribing to our email newsletter at arthousegarage.com/subscribe, or you can email me directly, andrew@arthousegarage.com. And of course, follow on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd. Just search at Art House Garage in all those places, or find links in the show notes. And that will do it for this episode. Thank you again so much for listening. And until next time, keep it snob free.